welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and this hour continuing stories, where we'll begin two 13-part series from Among Literature's Best. Later on, it's part one and two of Frankenstein from the early 1930s, but first, James Fenimore Cooper's The Deerslayer, produced in 13 parts in 1932. Here's part one, called Surrounded by the Iroquois.
To hear the first episode of The Deerslayer, dramatized and directed by Charles Frederick Lindsley. Leather Stocking Tales, written by James Fenimore Cooper, bring to you faithfully and in detail that historic character, Natty Bumppo, variously called by his Indian friends, Deerslayer, Hawkeye, and the Pathfinder. No more thrilling story of daring and human courage in the face of perilous border odds was ever penned, and you are invited to follow this story as it is presented to you over the station. The incidents of the tale occur between the years of 1740 and 1745, when the settled portions of the colony of New York were confined to a narrow section on each side of the Hudson. Broad belts of virgin wilderness, stretching away into New England, afforded forest covers to the noiseless moccasin of the native warrior as he trod the secret and bloody warpath. The leafy surface of the forest lies bathed in the brilliant light of a cloudless day in June, and the trunks of the trees rise in cloudy grandeur. As our curtain rises, a man of gigantic mold breaks from the tangled undergrowth into a small clearing. He is accompanied by a slender woodsman and scout, the hero and central figure of this tale, the Deerslayer.
Hello, Deerslayer. Here's daylight at last, and yonder is the lake.
Do you know this spot, Harry? Or do you shout at sight of the sun?
Both, lad, both. My name is not Hurry Harry if this not be the spot where the land hunters camped last summer. But this stomach of mine pints at late afternoon. Open the wallet and let's wind up for another 6 hours' run.
We dare not risk a halt now with these lurking Mingos likely to break out on us any minute.
We haven't struck a trail for 24 hours, boy. Fall to and prove your manhood on this poor devil of a doe with your teeth, as you've already done with your rifle.
There's little manhood in killing a doe. Though there might be some in bringing down a catamount.
Then why have the Delawares named you Deerslayer?
On account of a bold heart, as well as a quick eye and an active foot.
Bah, the Delawares themselves are no heroes. Well, they never would have allowed them loping vagabonds, the Mingos, to make them women.
You don't understand the matter rightly. The Mingos filled the woods with lies and break their treaties. I have now lived 10 years with the Delawares, and know them to be as manful as any other nation when the proper time comes to stir.
Harkee, Deerslayer, we may as well open our minds. We haven't known each other very long. Did you ever hit anything human or intelligible? Did you ever pull a trigger on an enemy that was capable of pulling one on you?
To own the truth, I never did. I hold it to be unlawful to take the life of a man except in open and generous warfare. The Delawares have been peaceful since my sojourn with them.
What? Did you never find a fellow thieving among your traps and skins and do the law on him with your own hands?
I'm no trapper, Harry. I live by the rifle, a weapon at which I will not turn my back on any man of my years. I never offer a skin that has not a hole in its head besides them which nature made to see with or to breathe through.
Aye, this is all very well in the animal way, though it makes but a poor figure alongside our scalps and ambushes. Shooting an Indian from ambush has acted up to his own. Now that we have a war on our hands, the sooner you wipe that disgrace off your character, the better man you'll be. I shall not keep your company long, friend. Unless you look higher than 4-footed beast to practice your rifle on.
Our journey is nearly ended, Master March. We can part tonight, if you see occasion. I have a friend waiting for me who will think it no disgrace to consort with a fellow creature that has never yet slain his kind.
I wish I knew what has brought your skulking Delaware into this part of the country. Where did you say this young chief was to give you a meeting?
At a small round rock near the foot of the lake, where the tribes resort to make treaties and bury the hatchet.
Common territory. I'd like to know what Floating Tom Hunter would say to that. He claims the lake is his own property. He'll not give it up to Mingo or Delaware without a battle for it.
What will the colony say to such a quarrel?
Not a thing. Pen was never set to paper concerning Hill or Valley hereaway. What Tom claims, he'll likely maintain.
By what I heard, Harry, this Floating Tom must be an uncommon mortal. What's the man's history and nature?
His nature's more muskrat than human. Some think he was a flea liver on the salt water, a companion of a certain kid who was hanged for piracy.
Then he was wrong, Harry. A man can enjoy plunder peaceably nowhere.
Some men have no peace if they don't find plunder, and some if they do. Old Tom seems to belong to neither set, as he enjoys his, if plunder he really has, with his daughters, in a very quiet and comfortable way, and wishes for no more.
He has daughters, too. Is there no mother, Harry?
There was once, but she's been dead and sunk these 2 good years.
Sunk?
I hope that's good English. The old fellow lowered his wife in the lake. He thought water washes away sin sooner than earth, I reckon.
Was the poor woman uncommon wicked that her husband should take such pains with her body?
Not unreasonable. She couldn't have been to have had such a daughter as Judith.
I've heard the name of Judith from the Delawares, too. From their words, I do not think the girl would much please my fancy.
Thy fancy? What the devil have you to do with a fancy? And that, too, concerning one like Judith. You are but a boy, a sapling. Judith has had men for her suitors. She's not likely to cast a look upon a half-grown creature like you.
It is June, and there's not a cloud between us and the sun. So all this heat is not wanted, Harry. Anyone may have a fancy, and a squirrel has a right to make up his mind touching a catamount.
But might not be wise to let the catamount know it. But you're young and thoughtless. I'll overlook your ignorance. Come, we'll not quarrel about a light-hearted jilting jade just because he happens to be handsome. Judith is only for a man whose teeth show the full marks. And it's foolish to be afraid of a boy. Yeah, but what do the Delawares say of the hussy?
They said she was fair to look on, pleasant of speech, but overgiven to admirers and light-mindedness.
The Delawares are devils incarnate. Now that's Judith's character to a ribbon. Telling the truth, Deerslayer, I should have married the gal 2 years ago. Had it not been for 2 particular things. One of which was this very light-mindedness.
And what may have been the other?
The other was an uncertainty about her having me. Yeah, she has failings that I find hard to overlook. And sometimes I swear I'll never visit the lake again.
Which is the reason you always come back. Nothing is ever made more sure by swearing about it.
And if you knew all I know concerning Judith, you'd find a little justification for cousin. You ought to see how she wears finery and the airs she gives herself when the gallants come over from the forts on Lake Mohawk.
That's unseemly in a poor man's daughter. The officers are all gentry. You look on Judith only with evil intention.
I know. I wish to look upon her as modest and becoming. And yet the clouds that drive among these hills are not more uncertain.
If I was you, I would think no more of such a woman, but turn my mind to the forest. That'll not deceive you.
If you know Judith, you'd see how much easier it is to say this than it would be to do it. Could I bring my mind to be easy about the officers, I'd carry the girl off to the Mohawk by force and make her marry me, Spider Whiplin. And I'd leave old Tom to the care of Hetty, his other child. Who, if she be not as handsome or as quick-witted as her sister, is much the most dutiful.
Is there another bird in the same nest? Delaware spoke to me of only one.
That's natural enough when Judith Hutter and Hetty Hutter are in question. Hetty is only comely, while her sister, I tell thee, boy, is such another as is not to be found between this and the sea. More than this, Hetty, I would say, is on the verge of ignorance. Even the Mingos know she's not just right in her mind, and she passes among them without harm.
I see. She belongs to them beings the Lord has in his special care. For he looks carefully to all who fall short of proper share of reason. The Redskins honor and respect them that are so gifted, knowing that the evil spirit delights more to dwell in an artful body than in one that has no cunning to work upon. But tell me, Harry, what reason have you to believe this gal has waited for you in the 6 months you've last seen her?
I haven't the gal's faith, I know. But if she's dared to marry in my absence, she'll be like to know the pleasure of widowhood afore she's 20.
You would not harm the man she's chosen, Harry, simply because she found him more to her liking than yourself.
Why not? When the enemy crosses my path, will I not beat him out of it? Look at me, 6'4". Maya Mandolinity's sneaking skin trader got the better of me in a matter that touches me as near as the kindness of Judith Hutter. Besides, when we live beyond the law, we must be our own judges and executioners. And if a man should be found dead in the woods, who is there to say who slew him? Even admitting the colony took the matter in hand and made a stir about it.
If that man should be Judith Hutter's husband after what has passed, I might tell enough at least to put the colony on the trail.
You half-grown venison-hunting bantling! You dare to think of informing against Hurry Harry, insomuch as a matter touching a mink or a woodchuck?
I would dare to speak truth, Harry, concerning you or any man that ever lived.
Why, you traitorous, sneaking reptile, I'll choke you to...
You may shake, Harry, until you bring down the mountain. But nothing but truth will you shake from me. It's probable that Judith Hutter has no husband to slay. You may never have the chance to waylay him. Else would I tell her of your threat in the first conversation I held with the gal.
I thought we had been friends, Deerslayer. But you've got the last secret of mine that'll ever enter your ears.
I want none of it to be like this. I know we live in the woods, Harry, and are thought to be beyond human laws. And perhaps we are so, in fact. But there is a law, and a lawmaker, that rules across the whole continent. He that flies in the face of either need not call me friend.
Damn me, Deerslayer, if I don't believe you're at heart a Moravian. And no fair-minded, plain-dealing hunter as you pretended to be.
Fair-minded or not, Harry. You'll find me as plain-dealing in deeds as I am in words. No, but this giving away to sudden anger is foolish. It proves how little you've lived with the red man. Judith Hutter is no doubt still single. And we'll say and think more about it.
I would have been foolish to have quarreled about an idea.
The sun is turning toward the afternoon sky. We'd better strike the trail again and make forward, so we can get an opportunity of seeing these beautiful sisters.
That's odd. I haven't heard a loon this early in the wood before.
Listen, Harry. You may be a good woodsman, but your ears deceive you this time. That's a poor imitation. That's no feathered bird.
You mean
a red man's signal, or I'm a half-breed. The Hurons are all around us, man, and they know our location. Oh, we've tarried too long with our hot words.
The lake is at hand, Deerslayer. If we can get off to Old Tom's castle, we're safe.
Our present duty is to find your hidden canoe. Are you sure you can recognize the spot?
Yes. It's in a hollow basswood. It ought not to be more than 100 yards off.
When did you get the word that the Mingos had taken to the warpath again?
The news came to the fort 2 weeks ago.
Any cause?
Nothing but their natural cussedness. There's the sign of the varmints again, if you'll be right. And our scalps grow more precious every minute. Ah, but we'll circumvent them. See the crooked branches of that sapling hooked on the branches of the basswood? That's the spot.
Are you certain?
It's my mark. I did it last winter when the young thing was bent down with snow. I fixed it then as my landmark.
And that must be your log 100 feet ahead.
Hey, listen. That's them. Lend a hand, Deerslayer. It's the canoe, all right. As snug as if it had been left in an old woman's cupboard. Lend a hand and we'll be afloat in a minute. Let the varmints yell. They'll have to swim for us if they want our scalp.
The Deerslayer, on Tuned to Yesterday, Episode 1 of 13 from 1932. James Fenimore Cooper's The Deerslayer was first published in 1841 and marked the last of his Leatherstocking Tales series. Now on to Part 2, called On Board the Ark.
You are about to hear another episode of The Deerslayer, dramatized and directed by Charles Frederick Lindsley.
and Hurry Harry are making their way to the palace of old Tom Hutter, a stout defense in the middle of a large lake in northern New York. The woods are filled with a band of Iroquois Indians on the warpath. The two white men have almost reached the edge of the lake in safety when they are startled by imitation bird calls, which they recognize as the presence of the enemy. Hurrying to an old hollow basswood, Harry finds a hidden canoe, and the two men push into the placid water just as the cries of their pursuers break out some distance away. The canoe is 100 yards from the shore before the first arrow touches a bowstring. Luck was with us, Harry, or we'd be prisoners by this time. Judging by their sounds, the Mengwe had cut off every retreat through the woods. Is this the only canoe on the lake?
There are two more, but they're hid so no redskin can find them. The devils will have to make a raft if they want to pursue us.
What's that I see off there abreast of us? Seems too small for an island and too large for a boat.
Well, that's Muskrat Castle, where Tom Hutter lives. That's the stationary house you see now. He has another one that floats, sometimes called the Ark, though I don't know why.
It must come from the missionaries, Harry. They say the Ark was once covered with water, and that Noah, with his children, was saved from drowning by building a vessel he called an Ark. Ah, but where do you suppose Hutter is now?
Down south, no doubt, anchored in one of the bays, fishing or trapping. But we'll be at the castle in a minute, and we can wait for him to return.
Ah, but this is a wonderful spot, Harry. Who calls himself lawful owner of these glories?
None but the king, lad. But he's so far away that his claim will never trouble Tom Hutter, who's likely to keep it as long as his life lasts.
He's a squatter, then?
I call him a floater.
Anyway, I envy the man. I envy him. This is a sight to warm the heart.
You've only to marry Hetty to inherit the castle. You take Hetty off the old man's hands, and I'll engage he'll give you an interest in every deer you can knock over within 5 miles of the lake. Right, now you can get a better view of the castle.
It's located safe enough. It's 0.5 mile from where we took the lake and 2 miles to the furthest point. Why, it's just a regular house almost, built on piles. How deep's the water out here?
There's a kind of shoal at this place which made the building easy once old Tom had brought off his logs from the bank.
It must have taken him a long time. Why did he build out here anyway?
The old fellow was burned out 3 times ashore. 3 times between the Indians and the hunters. And in one fray with the Redskins, he lost his only son. No one can attack him here without coming in a boat. And the plunder they'd get would hardly be worth the trouble digging out canoes. And besides, old Tom is well supplied with firearms and ammunition.
I guess you don't overrate the strength of his position from a military view. I notice the sides are made of tree trunks stood up on end. Yes, you're right, Master March. He could stand off an exposed enemy from there with little trouble and less danger.
Well, we've arrived, Deerslayer. Pull up here. Old Tom calls this front platform here his dooryard. And the gallants from the fort call it the court. The castle court.
Castle court?
Yes. Now, what a court can have to do here is more than I can tell, seeing there is no law. Hello, Tom. Anybody go home? I say, Hutter! Just as I thought. Not a soul here. All off on a voyage of discovery, I guess.
Shall we wait here for them to get back?
Old Tom has taken to a new calling recently. Has been trying his hand at the traps. Guess that's where he's gone, down to the other end of the lake. We better try to find him, I guess, and let him know about true conditions of things in the woods. That is, if he hasn't found out already. We'll probably find him in the south outlet.
I could content myself sitting here on this platform, watching the pines paint their pictures on this blue water. But I see you're thinking more of the beauties of Judith Hutter than those of this lake. I'll go along with you. So Hutter was burned out 3 times, you say, by the Mingos. Well, from what the Delawares tell me, I set the Mengwe down as thorough miscreants.
Aye, you may do that with a safe conscience. Or any other savage you meet.
That's not so of all red men, Harry. I've lived with the Delawares many years, and I know them to be generous and well-meaning people. The Indians are devils as a rule only when imposed on by the white man.
Deerslayer, you'll allow that a Mingo is more than half devil, but you'd persuade me that the Delaware tribe is made up of angels. White is the highest color, and therefore the best man. Black is next, and is put to live in the neighborhood of the white man as tolerable. And red comes last, which shows that those that made them never expected an Indian to be accounted more than half human.
God made all three alike, Harry.
Alike? Do you call me like an Indian?
Oh, you go off at half cock and don't hear me out. God made us all. White, black, and red. He made us in the main much the same in feelings. Though he gave each race its gifts. A white man's gifts are Christianized, while the redskins are more for the wilderness. A white man cannot ambush women and children in war, but a redskin may. It's lawful work for them, but for us, it would be grievous and unlawful work.
That depends on your enemy. As for scalping a savage, I look upon that pretty much the same as cutting off the ears of wolves for bounty, or stripping a bear of its hide. You know the county pays a bounty for a scalp just as it does for wolves' ears and crow's heads?
Aye, and a bad business it is, Hardy. In a state of lawful warfare, it's our duty to keep our state of compassionate feelings. But when it comes to scalps, it's a different matter. But it's useless for us to talk of these things. We have our own ideas. Let's keep a good lookout for your friend, Tom Hutter. We may pass him if he lies hidden under this bushy shore.
I have been looking for him. Is it possible the old chap has dropped down the river?
The river?
Yes. Most of these lakes, you know, have outlets. There's a narrow river off this one, not far to our right.
Where's the outlet? I see no opening in the banks of the trees that looks as if it would let a river run through it.
It passes between high, steep banks. The pines and basswoods overhang it. I guess we better start over there now.
Don't you think we're skirting pretty close to the shore for safety?
It's 2 miles across to where we first heard the varmints. They'd hardly be all around the lake. Anyway, we'll see the arc before long. Old Tom is up in these bushes somewhere looking at his trap.
Listen, Harry. What is that noise on the bank there?
It was too heavy for any light creature. Was it the tread of a man, do you think?
No, not a man. The tread was too heavy. Push into that log. I'll land and cut off the creature's retreat up to the plank yonder, be it a Mingo or only a muskrat.
There you are, Deerslayer. It's a buck. He's coming out of the plank yonder. I'll get him.
Hurry, you're a fool.
It's a miss, Deerslayer. Hey, but we can catch him before he swims across the neck there. Here, get back in the canoe.
I say you're a fool, Hardy, to pull a trigger before we had reconnoitered the shore and made certain that no enemies lurk about.
I tell you, the Indians are at the far end of the lake from here.
More than that, we don't want for food. My name may be Deerslayer, but I never kill an animal lest I need food or a skin. And I still say your shot may be a signal to the enemy.
It'll be a signal to old Tom to put the pot on. Come on, let's hunt up the ark before the sun goes down.
Is that the ark, Hardy? Breaking out of that bank of bushes? If my natural learning didn't teach me better, I'd think it a miracle that a boat like that could come right out of the trees.
Those trees grow down over the mouth of the river where Hutter has his traps.
Hey, ahoy there, Hutter. Let up on your sweep and take a couple of passengers.
Hurry. You become more reckless every minute. What with your rifle shooting and your bellowing like a bull, there'll be no earthly chance of dodging the circling redskins.
Hello, Hurry. Draw up and we'll give you a hand.
When we get aboard that ark, Deerslayer, its stout cabin will protect your carcass. Hey, hello, Tom. Meet Deerslayer here. He carries the best rifle in the woods.
Was that his piece we just heard?
No, it was mine. It was a bad shot at a buck that got away. Hey, where are the gals, Tom?
They're inside taking the kinks out of a mess of tackle. I looked for you last week, Hurry. A runner come down to warn all the trappers and hunters that the colony and the Canadas were in trouble again. And I felt lonesome with 3 scalps to see to and only 1 pair of hands to protect them.
That's reasonable. If I had 2 such daughters as Judith and Hetty, I'd tell the same story. In general, though, I'm satisfied to have my nearest neighbor 50 miles off.
I notice you didn't come into the wilderness alone this time, though.
Why should I, seeing Deerslayer here as a noted hunter among the Delawares? Should we have occasion to defend our traps, he'll be useful.
Young man, you're welcome. In such a time, a white face is a friend. I count on you as support. Are the savages close by as far as you know?
Why, we barely escaped them some hours ago. No man can say how close they might be on us now.
Then this ark is in an unfortunate position. I think we'd better get away from the mouth of this river. I'll pull up these lines and we'll start back to the castle. What's your errand in this quarter, Deerslayer?
'Tis soon told, Tom. When the news come among the Delawares where I live that wampum and a hatchet were to be sent into the tribe, they wished me to go out among my own people and get the exact state of things. This I did, and after delivering my talk to the chiefs, I met an officer of the crown who had money to send to the tribes further west. This was thought a good chance for me and Chingachgook, a young chief who's never struck a foe, to go on our first warpath in company. An appointment was made for us to meet at a rock at the foot of this lake.
He's to meet me at sunset tomorrow evening. I fell in with Harry here, who was starting for these parts, and we agreed to journey in company.
I was in the woods this afternoon, and I found this moccasin in a trail. Maybe they both belong to your friend who's come ahead of his time. Can you tell me if this is Delaware fashion?
Let's see. No, that's not Delaware made.
Hmm.
I should say that the moccasin has a northern look and come from beyond the lakes.
If that's the case, you did wrong, Harry, to fire in wartime without good occasion. Take hold of this sweep and we'll get underway.
It's getting dark in this river mouth, and I'll be glad to get into the light of the lake again. Although I don't think
that... Look out for that sapling that hangs low in the water just ahead on your right there, Harry.
Look there, Tom. In the branches of that beech tree. Up on the second limb. What do you see?
Damn it, but your eyes are keen, friend. They're Indians, or my name's not Tom Hunter.
And there's six of them. I was right about the moccasin.
They're in war paint, Deerslayer. We're trapped. Pull, Harry. Pull for your life as you love Judith Hunter. Pull, man. Pull!
The Deerslayer, on Tuned to Yesterday, Part 2 of 13 from 1932. We'll be picking up on Parts 3 and 4 next week at the very same time. This is an hour of series on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Lifonier. Now, the talented George Edwards players, hailing originally from Australia, bring us a production of Frankenstein in 13 parts. This was first released in 1938. Now, Episode 1.
Present George Edwards in Frankenstein. The good ship Voyager had been on a journey of exploration towards the North Pole. She was homeward bound, but unfortunately, the icy grip of the northern winter closed in, and the Voyager was surrounded by great blocks of solid ice. Her captain and crew were prepared for a weary wait before the thaw set in, and they could continue their journey home. Shortly after noon, Captain Walton and his first mate, Mr. Boyd, were standing on the deck of the Voyager. They looked out across the icy waste.
Well, Mr. Boyd, I think we will be here for quite a considerable time yet. There's no sign of the thaw setting in.
The trouble is to keep the crew occupied, Captain. And they're beginning to grumble a good deal already.
Well, give them as much work as you can. After all, we were prepared for something like this. We have ample supplies of provisions. I will take all responsibility for my men. And I can promise you that they will all return safely to England.
Captain,
what ails you, Mr. Boyd?
Look there. Coming across the ice.
Man. Are all the crew accounted for, Mr. Boyd?
No one has left the vessel, sir.
Approaches the side of the vessel. Ahoy there!
Mr. Boyd. The ship here. No one. I must be dreaming. This is another secret of my tortured brain.
I can assure you this is a ship. Give orders of the strangers to be helped aboard, Mr. Boyd.
Aye, aye, sir.
What ship is this? Whither are you bound?
My men are coming to help you aboard now, sir. Bring him up that rope ladder. Steady there.
Stranger appears to speak good English.
Yes. I wonder where he came from. I can't understand it. Man wandering about all alone out here. The wind and the snow is howling about us.
They're bringing him aboard now, sir.
Who is the captain of this vessel?
I am the captain. My name is Wolf.
And whither is the vessel bound?
We have been on a voyage of exploration towards the North Pole. We commenced our journey homeward. The ice closed in on us. We are staying here until the thaw sets in.
May I crave your hospitality and shelter?
Most certainly, sir. May I ask your name?
Victor Baron Frankenstein. I am ill and weak.
Careful, he will fall.
All right, sir, I have him.
I must express my sorrow for the trouble I am causing you, Captain. But I am seeking shelter. Then my quest must go on. I must always go on. I cannot die till I find that evil, that demon, which I unloosed upon the world.
You speak strange words, sir.
Forgive me. If I can but crave your kindness, some food, and I will...
Mr. Boyd, take Baron Frankenstein below to my cabin. See that he is made comfortable there. Give him food and drink. Let the ship's surgeon attend to him.
You are giving him your cabin, sir?
Why not? You heard my orders. Have a hammock slung for me in the cabin.
Aye, aye, sir.
Well, Mr. Boyd, how does the stranger progress?
We put him to bed, sir. He slept for quite a long time. He seems better now, but I think his mind is rambling.
Why do you say that?
Well, ever and anon he speaks of some demon, some fearful monster. He peers through the porthole. We had to use force on one occasion to persuade him to return to his bed.
Strange. Perhaps his wanderings have deranged his mind.
Do you think it is safe to leave him without a guard? Do you think we should take the precaution of locking your door, sir?
He appears to be a gentleman. No doubt he has a strange story to tell. Has he mentioned anything which might supply a key to this mystery? Or why he was wandering about here in these icy wastes?
It says that he was searching for an evil spirit, for a destroyer, a taker of human life. There's something about the man which makes me afraid, sir.
Oh, boy, the man could do you no harm. I will go down and speak with him myself.
Do you wish me to accompany you, Captain?
No, I will go alone.
But should he become violent?
Oh, the man is weak and ill. How can he become violent?
He struggled with us when we dragged him away from the porthole. He said he must be watching. Forever watching.
Poor devil. I will try to persuade him to tell me his story. Wait here on deck, Boyd. I will send for you if I need you. I came to inquire after your health.
Why was I locked in this cabin? Why are you keeping me a prisoner?
I am considering your own safety.
Considering my own safety? I tell you, sir, my life means nothing to me. I wish to repair the great wrong which I have done. My friends, my family, they have all been murdered. And I am the murderer.
You know not what you say.
Look on me, Captain. You are looking on a man who unleashed a horror on this world. A man who was responsible for the murder of his beloved wife, his best friend, for the murder of little children.
Are you a fugitive from justice?
I am not a fugitive. I have been punished because I tried to usurp the rights of God. Now I seek to repair the wrong which I did.
I do not understand you.
Bid your sailors keep a close watch somewhere in these white wastes. Somewhere near here, there is a monster, a creature who delights in taking human life. None of you is safe.
Your wanderings and your hardships have caused you to imagine these things.
No, I swear it is the truth. Near this vessel, I saw a giant footprint in the snow. It must have been the footstep of the monster which I created.
Would you like to tell me something of your story?
Captain Walton, I do not know if you will believe my story when I tell it to you. Perhaps you may have proof. Perhaps someday you will look upon this monster. Oh, may heaven grant that you do not.
If it will help you to tell me about it, Baron Frankenstein, I assure you I will make a ready listener.
Be seated, Captain. I have told you that my name is Baron Victor Frankenstein. I was born in Geneva, and my family is one of the most distinguished in that republic. My father had filled several public situations with honor and reputation. He was respected by all who knew him for his integrity. So you can see, sir, that I grew up in the most ideal surroundings. When I was 17, my parents sent me to the University of Ingolstadt, and there I became interested in science. During my attendance at the university, my beloved mother died. I returned home for a brief while, and whilst at home, I fell deeply in love with my cousin Elizabeth, and I determined to marry her as soon as my course at the university had been completed. I returned to Ingolstadt and continued with my studies. I read deeply, and gradually a most dreadful thought occurred to me. From my readings and my studies, I realized that it would be possible for man to create man. I became aware of the tremendous power of electricity. I was caught once in a terrific thunderstorm. I observed how the lightning had split an oak tree in half, and the knowledge came to me that just as electricity can destroy life, so can it create. Then and there, my horrible resolve was born. I vowed that I would not rest until I had created a man.
This seems incredible, Baron Frankenstein.
Oh, it may seem incredible to one who is not acquainted with science, but I studied and experimented, and when I retired from the university, I begged my father to build me a laboratory near our old home. He agreed to do this, and then I took into my confidence an old family servant called Giulio. The man was crippled, but he had a keen and agile brain, and he was interested in my experiments. For months we worked. I intended to create a creature who would be both strong, good to look upon, and noble.
Are you speaking the truth, Baron Frankenstein?
I swear that I speak the truth.
Did you succeed with this monstrous project?
I swear a holy oath that I succeeded. I created a man. I usurped the rights of God. Did I say I created a man? That is not the truth. I created a monster.
A monster?
Why, you might well shudder, Captain Walton. I will tell you the story of the creation of this monster. I will tell you why you found me wandering about the white waste.
How did you get here?
I chartered a ship. I paid a crew. We were wrecked upon an iceberg and all perished save one person. I was the miserable person who lived on because I had to live. I cannot die until I have destroyed that which I have created.
But if you created this monster in Geneva, what is it doing here out in the white waste of the north?
Oh, I'm tired, my friend. The story is too dreadful and horrible. Let me regain my strength so that I may complete my work. What I have created must be destroyed.
Oh, my poor fellow. I assure you that we will give you every care and attention.
Still, you do not believe me.
Merciful heaven, what was that?
The monster, it is here, aboard this vessel.
That was the most ghastly laugh I have ever heard.
Open the door. Let me complete my work now.
God, did you hear that? Stand aside.
No, we shall not open this door.
Mr. Boyd! Mr. Boyd! Come back at once and bring a pistol with you.
Frankenstein, Untuned to Yesterday, Episode 1 from 1938. Mary Shelley's now immortal work, no pun intended, was first published anonymously in 1818 in London when she was at the age of 21. Now on to Episode 2 of Frankenstein from 1938.
Present George Edwards in Frankenstein. The good ship Voyager was held fast in the northern ice pack. The captain and crew were astonished when a stranger came staggering across the ice and asked for shelter. This stranger was Baron Victor Frankenstein. He was placed in the captain's cabin, and then he commenced to tell his story. Shortly afterwards, however, a ghastly laugh was heard outside the cabin door. Frankenstein weakly attempted to get out of bed, but the captain pushed him back and called to the first officer to come to his aid.
Captain Walton, you are condemning your first officer to death. A monster is out there. A blood-crazed, conscienceless beast. Oh, let me go.
You are weak and ill. You can do nothing, Baron Frankenstein.
Captain, what happened?
Did you bring a pistol?
Yes, some of the detectives. I came down with them anyway.
Is there anyone out there now?
No one, sir.
Very well. I shall unlock the door. Now come in.
What did you see? Tell us what happened.
I heard the captain calling, and I dashed down the companionway. Then out of the darkness, a huge figure seemed to leap at me. I was knocked aside. When I arose, there was no sign of anyone. I dashed up on deck again. There was no one there. The man on watch reports that he saw nothing.
The monster was here. You are lucky to be alive.
I believe your story now, Baron Frankenstein.
I created that monster, and I must live until I kill him. That is my sole task on this earth. What I created, so I will destroy.
What does he mean, sir?
It is a strange story, Mr. Boyce. But Baron Frankenstein is too exhausted to talk anymore tonight. Pray remain in the bunk, Baron.
I must try to get to sleep. I must recover my strength. I must have strength enough to kill the monster.
You shall have every care and attention here. I will place a man on guard outside your door.
I do not think the monster will return tonight.
The storm has become worse. The blizzard is raging now. It would be difficult for anyone to live out there.
Let us trust that this monster perishes in the storm.
I am to be called if any sign is seen of him. In the meanwhile, let me sleep. Then on the morrow, if I feel refreshed, I will tell all my story, Captain Walton.
Very well, Baron Frankenstein. Mr. Boyd, you will go up on deck now, and you will arrange for two men to stand guard outside this door. I will share your cabin with you tonight.
Aye, aye, sir.
I bid you good night, Baron Frankenstein. We will meet on the morrow. Much better today, Baron Frankenstein.
Yes, Captain. I feel much better. Was there any sign of the monster during the night?
Nothing was seen.
Please be seated. I know that you are interested in my story and you are puzzled by these strange happenings.
I am extremely puzzled.
Well, I told you that after I left the university, my father built a laboratory near our house. Each day I used to spend hours in this laboratory working with my servant Julio. Day after day, I read and studied so that my great experiment would be a success. Sometimes by night, Julio and I would visit graveyards to exhume freshly buried bodies. I was going to make a man, and the creature of my making was to be beautiful. I slaved and labored, neglecting my family and my friends, neglecting my fiancée, Elizabeth. It so happened that at that time, my greatest friend, Ernst Claval, came to stay at our home. He had been at the university with me, and he had a vague inkling as to the nature of my experiments. However, I had become sullen and morose. I shunned my friend, and as my experiment neared completion, well, I became possessed by a strange, tense excitement. Imagine me in my laboratory late one afternoon, Captain Walton. I glanced out of the window and saw that the sky was dark and overcast. My servant Julio stood by my side. Now and again, he would glance over at the great bench on which lay a huge, inanimate figure swathed around with yards of bandages. I walked over to where the figure lay. Julio followed me. Julio, I have news for you. I think that tonight we'll see the end of our work.
Do you mean that the figure will come to life tonight, my master?
I hope so. If the threatened thunderstorm takes place, there will be sufficient electricity to bring life to this inanimate mass. Look at it, Julio. At present, it is a lifeless mass shaped in the form of a man. For months, we have worked over it. Tonight, if the storm breaks, we shall raise this figure to the top of the tower in the laboratory, and there it will stay for 1 hour while the thunder crashes and the lightning flashes. Then we shall lower the body onto this bench once again. The wrappings will be taken off, and who knows? I may have created a man. Think of it, Julio. My work will be rewarded.
I am afraid, Master. We should not do this.
Fool, why are you afraid? I am about to make a name for myself. I will be the greatest man in the world because I have created another in my own likeness. Throughout the centuries, men have tried to do this, but I will succeed. I know it.
You may not be meant to succeed.
Who is there?
It is Clever here. May I come in, Victor?
Yes. Yeah. All right, Julio. Unlock the door.
Oh, thank you. I wondered if I might watch you at work.
Ernst, the time is right now for you to share my secret. My experiments are almost at an end.
I suspect the nature of your experiments, Victor. And I almost dread to ask if my suspicions are correct.
Look on this bench. Tell me what you see, Ernst.
A huge, inanimate figure swathed around with bandages.
My creation. Tonight, this figure shall have life.
Victor, you must not do it. Man is not meant to do that.
Or you are like Julio. He is also afraid.
I want to speak with you privately. Bid Julio be gone.
You may go, Julio, but be here tonight at 7 o'clock. We shall wait for the storm to break. The clouds are banking up now.
I will obey you, my master.
Victor, your life is bound up in this strange experiment, which I do not think for one moment will succeed. But might I point out that you are in love with a very beautiful and charming girl. You are neglecting her, and she feels this neglect keenly.
Clerval, my friend, I know that I have been neglecting Elizabeth, but she will be proud of me, proud to marry me. I will be hailed as the greatest scientist the world has ever known.
I beg of you to desist in this experiment. Do not try to bring life to this body tonight. Destroy what you have already done. Then marry Elizabeth and go away somewhere for a long holiday. You do not look well, my friend.
Oh, I have been working too hard. But you ask too much of me, Ernst. I cannot give up my life work.
Do you love your work more than you do Elizabeth?
Nein. I love Elizabeth very dearly. But I must do something with my life. I have always wanted to be a great scientist. My discovery will revolutionize the world. It will be possible to make men. Do you not understand?
It is not possible. Experiments like this are not meant to succeed. You are usurping the right of God.
Ernst, you are my best friend. You cannot seriously ask me to give up this work. I am going to ask you to be here in this laboratory with me tonight to watch as I unbind the bandages from this figure and to know that my experiment has succeeded.
Very well, Victor. Since you insist. But I do think you should take Elizabeth into your confidence. Let her come here tonight.
Oh, she will be afraid.
We will all be afraid. But without wishing to dampen your ardor, let me assure you that I do not think this experiment will succeed.
We shall see.
Well, come with me now. Speak to Elizabeth. Tell her that you have been neglecting her and ask her to be present tonight.
I will do that.
We will go and seek out Elizabeth now.
Well, Captain, I sought out my fiancée. I told her the truth. At first she was horrified, but gradually she became interested and she consented to be present in the laboratory that night. After dinner, the storm developed rapidly. The thunder roared, and there were great streaks of forked lightning. Together, Elizabeth, Ernst, and myself went to the laboratory. There we found Julio awaiting us, and I led the way to the bench on which lay the inanimate figure. When we reached the bench... Well, my friends, I feel that you are about to witness one of the most extraordinary things in the annals of the world's history. Before you, you see a great inanimate figure entirely covered in bandages. By means of pulleys, Julio and I will raise that figure to the top of the tower, where it will remain for an hour. Then we will lower it, and I think the figure will have life.
No, you cannot do it, Victor. You must not. I am afraid.
Elizabeth, you said you had confidence in me.
Will you promise me this, Victor? If the experiment is a failure, will you marry me and let us go away together? Never attempt to do this again. It is madness.
I promise that if the experiment is a failure, I will discontinue all attempts. Now, does that satisfy you, Elizabeth?
It does.
Oh, do not worry, Elizabeth. I feel sure that this experiment cannot succeed.
You hope it does not succeed, Ernst, but we shall see. The storm is at its height now. Come, Julio, help me to place the body on the lift. Now, careful. Roll it over.
Victor, I beg of you, do not do it.
Quiet, please. Now, Julio, pull the ropes and I will assist you. Pull. See, my friend, the body is going up to the tower. There it will be exposed to the full fury of the storm. Watch.
The lightning frightens me. But this is a dreadful storm.
The body is in place now. It will remain there for an hour. We must be patient. We will wait here. And in an hour's time, I will lower the body, unwrap the bandages, and perhaps I will have created...
Please proceed, Baron Frankenstein. Tell me what happened.
I can tell you no more today, Captain. I am weary now, and the memory of the past upsets me. Please be patient.
I will be patient. I will leave you to rest now, but I will return later, anxious to hear the remainder of your story.
Frankenstein, Untuned to Yesterday, Episode 2 of 13, released for syndication in 1938. And that wraps up this hour of series, Untuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next week at the very same time as we continue these classic stories. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.